I'm Madeline Bunting and welcome to Banned and Burnt, a podcast for Comment is Free. It's been 20 years since the Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran pronounced that all Muslims had a duty to kill the author Salman Rushdie because his book, The Satanic Verses, had been disrespectful to the Prophet. Rushdie's fourth novel was published at the end of 1988. It focuses on two men, the Indian legendary movie star Jibril Farishta and Saladin Chamcha, a man of a thousand voices, who plummet to earth after the explosion of their jetliner. A fantastic tale using dreams and revelations, some of which loosely refer to the life of the Prophet. For Rushdie, the book was a critique of power, mullahs and politicians. Within weeks of the publication of the novel, however, Islamic groups were accusing the writer of blasphemy and burning copies of the books in the streets.
He's a devil, the true devil himself come to life.
We all feel like that, all of us.
We are true Muslims, and you are true Christians, you will do the same as we are going to do. If I get the chance, or any one of my colleagues get the chance, we will definitely do what the Ayatollah says.
As well as forcing the author into hiding for nearly a decade, the fatwa's repercussions were profound. It brought the West into conflict with Muslims all over the world. It became a battle over freedom of speech, the nature of multiculturalism, and the identity of British Muslims. Joining me in the studio to discuss this extraordinary episode are three people who have been deeply affected by it. Sir Iqbal Sukrani made his name as a leader of the British Muslim community during the protests, becoming a joint convener of the newly founded UK Action Committee on Islamic Affairs. We have Lisa Apinezi. She's a writer and president of English Pen, and at the time of the fatwa, she was deputy director of the Institute of Contemporary Arts, as well as a passionate defender of Rushdie and a friend. And finally, we have Zahra Hussain, a visual artist and Muslim of a generation which grew up in the shadow of these events. Let's go back 20 years. Iqbal, you were at the forefront of protests. Let's hear your demands to Rushdie expressed in a letter you wrote to The Independent.
One, to withdraw and pulp the remaining copies of the book. Two, to undertake not to publish in any form or manner any further editions or translations of the novel. Three, tender an unqualified apology to all the followers of Islam. And four, to pay damages to an agreed Muslim charity.
Iqbal, how does all this look 20 years later to you?
Well, one looks at the whole central issue, and the issue was of sacrilege, vilification. And that stance that was taken at that time remains until today. Because sacrilege is not only abhorrent, but it also affects the whole section of the community in terms of its interactions with the larger society in bringing that better understanding. The issues or demands that were made at that time, some of them were actually met in terms of the apology that was given, perhaps not really of substantive nature, because nothing changed. And the whole campaign was based on the publication of the book. So the culprit were basically the publisher, not the author. And the way the whole campaign was being seen by the media, by the rebel establishment, was more or less focused on the author rather than on the publishers, who were the real platform of propagating the filth, as we called it at that time.
So the fatwa should not have been on Rushdie, but on the publishers.
Well, the fatwa was, a totally different concept that had come in. It more or less sort of came out into the open. At the time when the book was published, it was quite apparent that the punishment for the particular offence of Shatmun Nabi was a capital offence, the vilification of the personality of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. But at the same time, it was quite clear that its application was simply not applicable in the UK. It applied in a Muslim country, and there was a due process which had to be carried out before its implementation.
Lisa, what does it all look like to you 20 years later?
Well, let me just say that what Iqbal has described is certainly not my memory of the time. And I think those protests actually were both possibly against the law in their calls for murder of Rushdie and his publishers, which is what the fatwa was about too. And there was, if you like, a concatenation between what happened in Bolton and Bradford and then the oncoming of the fatwa from this old and disgruntled Ayatollah who so evidently used it for political purposes. In any case, how does it look like to me now? Well, you know, if we go back into that time, you can still hear a note of passion in my voice, because it was the first time for a very, very long time in Western culture that anything of this kind, asking for a writer's death because of a very highly imaginative, wonderful work of fiction, that was on the table. And this was a kind of political maneuvering which didn't feel right, because none of those people who protested, or very few of them, would indeed have set out to read that book. So, in fact, things were happening politically which were expressed in terms of religion. The second thing at the time, which was very surprising and indeed shocking to many of us, was that suddenly we had a political grouping which had, to many of us, and we were people of the left and liberal left, looked as if it had changed its stance. In other words, people who had protested against oppression, against racism that was indeed perhaps being enacted on the immigrant communities, now took on a banner of a religion. And that was rather surprising to us, because many of those same people were friends, had belonged to political groupings, which did not bear the term or the identity group Islam. So it was part of that, if you like, what's now called the culturalization of politics and the moving into a particular kind of identity which took religion as its core.
Zara, let me come to you. How old were you in 1989?
I was 9 years old.
You were nine. And do you have any memories of
definitely,
it going on?
Definitely. From my point of view, it was the first time in my life that I had identified myself as a Muslim, and how other people had started to identify me and my family as Muslims where we were living in the local area. And it had a massive impact. I mean, I think if you look at it from the long view, Asians in this country, first of all, were called black under a broad terminology that everybody that's not white is black. And then there'd been a fight to be referred to as Asian. And then beyond this, I think this was a really, looking back, it's an important point, because for a whole generation like me, we were suddenly very aware of our Muslim identity. We very clearly knew at 9 years old, we were different to Sikhs and Hindus. We were different to black people. We were Muslims. And this was a specific Muslim issue. I mean, you'd be surprised at how powerful that was. So for us, I think growing up at this time, it's quite a profound, memorable experience being faced with questions like, do you want Salman Rushdie to be killed? What do Muslims say about this? And we were getting these questions as very young children.
And was your family appreciative of the leadership of people like Iqbal Sukrani?
I remember leaflets coming home. I remember my father going to the mosque. I remember my mother and father being very, very, very upset. From their point of view, they could not understand why something they held so dear to their hearts, something so sacred as the memory of the Prophet, in our religion, I think it's very difficult if you're not practicing to understand the love that people have for the Prophet Muhammad and how that's in our religion. So I remember my parents being very upset, and I was curious as to why they were so upset. And I knew that it's something that affected them quite profoundly.
Iqbal, let's be honest. Some of the language you used was inflammatory. This, for example.
My personal view is that perhaps death would be a bit too easy for him to get away with it. But I think his life, his mind is going to be tormented for the rest of his life as to what he has done, unless he asks for his forgiveness to Almighty Allah.
How do you feel now about that?
Well, this is the clip that has been played too often. And it's important, which I've tried to clarify on a number of occasions, that if one listens to the clip, what one does not hear is the end bit. It says that death would perhaps be too easy. And that was directly in reference to someone who wants to kill him. But that is not the answer. The answer is that let a person learn the lesson. Let him live. Because death is not the answer. And he should not be killed. And this was a very clear message that we would not be, A, following Islamic instructions in terms of living in a non-Muslim country and killing somebody. And number two, that death, he would be made a martyr. and therefore he should live, and he should live to learn the lesson, and so others should learn the lesson as well. That was the message that really was there, and that is precisely the whole point that has come out. And
so you were trying to redirect the anger of the Muslim protesters to avoid his death.
Indeed, it was because, again, to correct Lisa on the two very important points, the publication of the book took place in September 1988. The fatwa came in February, and the campaign for the last sort of 4 or 5 months was concentrated on the book. It was not concentrated on the author. However, what the fatwa did was redirect the whole campaign.
Can I just ask you something, Iqbal? Because what you're saying is that this was a way of redirecting the anger.
Yes.
On the other hand, its impact on the rest of Britain was horrific. As you say, this phrase has haunted you for the last 20 years. Would
yes.
you acknowledge now that the choice of wording may have been intended in one way, but it was certainly understood in another way and has been very damaging to the view that many people had of Muslims and what they were trying to
Well, it was a view that I had expressed as an individual. And certainly as an individual, one can see the damage it causes to me personally when somebody perhaps assumes or interprets as though here I was saying that it's easy to kill him. That's what I was told by somebody.
Excuse me, Iqbal, can I just say something? Sure. Here you are using all the arguments that most of us would use for the freedom of expression and for the existence of all kinds of literature, and you're using it about yourself. You're saying, oh, you misinterpreted what I said. You didn't quite understand me. But you were allowed to say that. You weren't arrested for putting leaflets through people's houses, asking them to protest about a book they had never read by an author who they probably hadn't heard of at that time.
Sure.
And you were using this as a political moment,
yes.
and yet you were quite happy to want the repression of that writer's way of seeing the world, whereas you're extremely happy to use the benefits of that free expression to express your own. I think there's a very deep contradiction here.
I think this is precisely what I'm trying to say. I'm exercising the same democratic right, which I was at the time, to condemn the publication of a book in terms of what it hurts me, in exactly the same way as you are defending the author.
Well, that's right.
For his right to say.
And both of you are allowed to speak.
Exactly. Now, this is the, and you need to give a specific example. The leaflets that had gone out into the letterboxes, none of them had asked for the death of the author. They're asking, we need to protest. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with the protest. Today, protests are being made on a daily basis, on something
on
people
On the other
feel-
hand, the clip that we heard earlier in the programme was clearly protesters in the UK, in
yes.
Bradford's, saying they were definitely going to obey the instructions of the Ayatollah.
Yes.
So however it happened, it was clear that the Ayatollah's fatwa had an immediate and dramatic impact in the UK. Where
it may have it, but the point is, has it been implemented? That's the proof of the pudding, number one. Number two, yes, there were individuals, Madeline,
yeah.
who were very deeply hurt. And we were going back to the Islamic principle, which we were supported by, that if you are saying that that is what Islam teaches us, to take that vengeance and revenge, then it is not so. Because the scholars were very clear that we should protest, we should exercise our right to say what is wrong, because at the end of the day, we felt it was for the benefit of the society. At no time we can quote a single example of the mainstream organizations where we have said anything which is other than what we stand for. And that is the right to protest what is wrong, in the most decent, proper way that is acceptable
in society.
The forces
that you put into play, I don't think in all instances were useful to the society as a whole, or indeed useful to the people who came out for the kind of protest that you wanted. In fact, you know, some of the effects of it were simply to play back on that group and its very, very talented artists and writers and actually take a toll on them.
Can I just ask a question of you, Iqbal, which is that some have said you did very well out of the protests, that in fact they launched a career for you, a very successful career, and a prestigious one. You met government ministers, you became Secretary General of the Muslim Council of Britain, and indeed you are now Sir Iqbal. What's your response to that? Is that unfair?
Well, I think in many ways it is unfair, because this was an area where one had to commit one's time, basically a very good part of one's life, to the cause, and that is to serve the community for the betterment of the society at large. I was a profession running a successful business, and all that had to be left aside. And this was something where it was not an individual who sort of went for that position. It was the consensus that prevailed within the organizations that one was forced to take upon. And all my work over the last 30 years is purely based upon the needs of the community.
Zara, let me come to you. It was a key moment in forging British Muslim identity, as you've already vividly described. Did we have lions being led by donkeys?
I mean, to go back to Bradford, I mean, Bradford is an area I'm very familiar with. I've spent time there, I've lived there, and I'm from the north. I think when there was protest, the protest exploded into something larger than the Rushdie affair itself. And people were not just protesting about Rushdie. There were a lot of grievances came to an explosive head. People were protesting about chronic unemployment. People were protesting about bad housing. This is a Kashmiri community. They weren't...
So this was mainly a protest about poverty?
I think
there's
a protest about structural issues, structural problems. There were some Asians that were doing very well. There was a whole scene, there was a Bhangra scene, there was an emergent culture. But as yet, I mean, even today, I wouldn't say there was a British Muslim culture that's emerged, that's confident, that's there, that people kind of fall back on. So there was this Asian identity that it was becoming acceptable to be Asian. Thatcher was going on about successful Asian businessmen. But for these Muslims, there wasn't that aspect of society that was catered for.
Have your say at commentisfree.co.uk.
Now, to some, this wasn't about Britain at all.
Amir Tahiri, The Times, 13th of February 1989. Khomeini's motives for giving his order are not entirely religious. In the last few months, he has suffered a number of humiliating setbacks: the ceasefire with Iraq, the election of a woman prime minister in Pakistan, and, with the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan, the failure of his protégés to secure a prominent role in the assembly organised by the Mujahideen in Rawalpindi. He has, therefore, been looking for an issue likely to stir the imagination of the poor, illiterate masses. Waving Rushdie's novel, the Ayatollah hopes to tell his supporters that plots against Islam have not ceased, and that if one war has ended, another is about to begin.
So Rushdie's book got tied up in Iran's internal politics and was used as a trophy issue in the rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia as leaders of global Islam. Lisa, to what extent did you realise, or did you think at the time, that this was in part about a marginalised people looking for an identity?
What was clear to me, I mean, and, you know, it's always hard to go back in time when so much has changed in between, but I do remember taking part in a great many panels with people who were from, you know, Pakistan, Bangladesh. And what was clear to them, as well as to me, was that all these people may indeed have had those identities, but their understanding of what it was to be a Muslim, all of these understandings were very different. There was no one single thing called a Muslim. And I think what I wanted to ask both my fellows here before was that, you know, they use this word Muslim as if it were a single unitary category. It patently isn't. We just have to look at the politics of the world to see that it isn't. I know that Iqbal, for example, is not on the same side as a great many Iranian Muslims would be, and certainly the Ayatollah was at his time. And I don't think that has done either the people here who would use or term themselves Muslim, or indeed Islam as itself, very much good. And one of the things that writers do, that novelists do, is they do particularise, and they don't try to use these great global banner-waving categories and say, this is what things are.
Just picking up on Lisa's point there, Zara, at the beginning of the programme we heard protesters saying, we are true Muslims. To what extent was this about an effort to define what British Islam was, and has it been useful?
Definitely there was an effort to define ourselves as who we were and where we were going. We're immigrants, we're children of immigrants, and we're emotionally disconnected from our origins. Our family ties to our country of origins have become are breaking down. And the challenge is how to facilitate an inclusive version of Islam.
Do you accept Lisa's point that it was a disservice, that it imposed a sort of monolithic understanding of Islam?
I still feel that. I still feel when people go to the Muslim Council of Britain and say, you represent Muslims, they don't. I mean, now, my generation, they go to the internet. We're living in a very individualistic society. People define themselves by their own rules. There's very few people would say that one person or one organisation represents me. It's the age of the internet. But linking into the point that you made earlier, I do think that significant organisations like the Muslim Brotherhood, countries like Iran, Syria, Libya, did see that there were significant Muslim populations in the West. And I definitely think there was an attempt to manipulate and to kind of influence these Muslims. And I think that was a difficulty.
Obviously, one of the big debates at the time was freedom of expression. The book burning and the fatwa prompted a passionate defence of the freedom of the imagination as a crucial Western value that could not be compromised. And Lisa, you were central to this. Your organisation, the ICA, held an event in which the playwright Harold Pinter delivered a speech written by Salman Rushdie.
The idea of the sacred is quite simply one of the most conservative notions in any culture, because it seeks to turn other ideas, uncertainty, progress, change, into crimes. But while the novel answers our need for wonderment and understanding, it brings us harsh and unpalatable news as well. If religion is an answer, if political ideology is an answer, then literature is an inquiry. Great literature, by asking extraordinary questions, opens new doors in our minds.
Lisa, this is a very critical definition of sacred, as always conservative. Do you go along with that?
Well, this is in the context of the first anniversary of the fatwa. And I think, if you ask me personally what I think it's fine for anyone to believe whatever it is that they want to believe. But in the public sphere, when religion, and indeed there is not just one religion, there are many religions, and all of the people who believe in these religions can feel rather adamant about them, and certainly their representatives and their clerics, who have a great deal of power, feel very adamant about them. When they enter the public sphere with their attempt to feel that everything that isn't of that faith insults them, then you have a complete closing down of thought, art, expression, and indeed many, many of the things that actually make our society, the good bits of our society, what it is, and many of the things that we've struggled for in Western culture for a very, very long time. You know, free expression didn't come overnight. It was a great battle against the encroachments of the state. And indeed, you know, when we champion free expression now, it's to do with imaginative literature, but it's also to do with the kind of closing down that any power, the powerful, always want to have and silence the weaker and those who criticize and question and try to stretch the boundaries in some way. So, you know, yes, I am an ardent person who would battle for free expression.
But in the public sphere, there is no such concept as the sacred.
I think not.
No.
I think in the public sphere, there is no sacred. Individually, there may be many things that are sacred to you. And indeed, you know, art may be sacred to
yes.
some people.
I wanted to draw in Zara at this point, because as a visual artist and as a Muslim, how do you reconcile those two ideas?
I think it's very interesting, because I would say my artwork is inspired by the sacred, and my inspiration comes from what I believe to be sacred in my religion and in my understanding of my religion. I would disagree. I think there are things that are sacred and things that are in the public sphere that are sacred. But coming back to the point, I think constructively criticizing Islam is valid. I think we've come to a point now that we understand that putting a death threat on someone for writing a novel is completely obscene and shouldn't have happened. People have the right to protest, but in no way should that be violent or should endanger someone's life. I think we've also come to a position now, young Muslims understand, we're not a mini Muslim state within England. We're not. We are Muslims living as a minority in this country. And by being here, we've accepted the social contract, that we accept the norms of this society. But I retain the right to protest. One of the things that I think is relevant is the Jonathan Ross. A lot of people found that distasteful. He's in the public sphere. He's being paid public money. And many, many people, whether you agree with him or not, wrote in, they said, we do not like what he's done. And there are some things, for example, the Holocaust, which was a terrible thing to happen. Many people would say that Holocaust denier ought to be punished. So I do believe there are things in the public sphere that people consider to be sacred or untouchable truths that yeah. we must respect
but
or abide by as a society.
Can I just say something? The point here is, yes, I mean, you may find many things offensive. And I find Jonathan Ross sometimes offensive, quite often. And I would want to be able to say to him, I find you offensive. But I do not want the state to legislate and close down on us because it has decided that one religion is more valid than another, or one form of speech is more valid than another.
But there are other forms of limiting speech in the public sphere, which are not about legislation. I mean, Iqbal, do you think in the last 20 years it's become easier in any way to talk about limitations that are arrived at, not by legislation, but by public consensus about what is inappropriate?
Yes, I think more and more is being discussed very openly now, bearing in mind the earlier point that there is already existing legislation where the state is making it absolutely clear into what is acceptable and what is not. We have the laws of defamation, the issues of treason are very, very clear. There are other examples where the state doesn't come in a form of legislation, but in terms of good practices, the Jonathan Ross is an extremely important example where even the Prime Minister came in. Now, these are very powerful messages going out. And that is, I think, what is important. But in terms of freedom of expression, the general point, there is never such thing as an absolute freedom of expression.
Right.
It doesn't exist anyway.
Lisa, has there been a chill factor in the last 20 years? Do you think writers and publishers have refrained from venturing into this territory?
I think it certainly has. I mean, theatre directors will tell you, some publishers will tell you, that it's much easier to write a book which has Christianity as a subject than it is to write a book which has Islam as a subject, simply because there is a kind of fear that there will be protest or there will be libel cases or, you know, you'll end up in trouble and expensive trouble in one way or another.
So Rushdie was unapologetic. It could be said that you failed, Iqbal.
Frankly, I wish I'd written a more critical book. I mean, a religion that claims that is able to behave like this, religious leaders, let's say, who are able to behave like this, and then say that this is a religion which must be above any kind of whisper of criticism. I mean, that doesn't add up. It seems to me that Islamic fundamentalists could do with a little criticism right now.
Well, if only I think Rushdie would have read a bit of Islamic history, he would have found that Islam has had hundreds of books well before, even famous books like Tabari, Ibn Sa'd, have been critical and have been examining in a very critical way some of the issues of theology. So I think we are not talking about issues of criticism. What we do oppose and what I think is not right for the society is issues of profanity, issues of sacrilege.
This happen again, do you think, Iqbal? The riots, the book burning, the protests, could it all happen again?
No, I think it will be in a different way. I mean, over the last 20 years, people's attitudes have changed in terms of how they respond to such actions. The situation that existed 20 years ago, as far as the Muslim community is concerned, there was very little access. Today, in terms of getting your message across to the media, saying Muslim presenters who are able to express themselves much more clearly, we had a very difficult time 20 years ago, Madeline, in terms of getting a message across to the media. I think it was a failure, one might admit, in getting the strength of the argument as to what we were really opposing really never came out.
Okay, and Zara, do you think it could happen again?
No, because I think we've learned as a community, as Muslims, that sometimes it's not worth it. And my message would be for Muslims today is to learn when to fight. We should be fighting for better housing. We should be fighting for less discrimination. Muslims are, you know, why are there so many Muslims in prisons? Why do we have so few opportunities in the world of work? We need to find out what to fight for. And I think, I mean, there's a lot of deep, deep concern, deep anger in the Muslim community about what's happening in Gaza. And I think there's been many protests and we're evolving, we're developing. And I think the next stage is for people to be more involved in civic and political life. We've evolved, we've grown up. And I think we've come to the point that burning books, it sent out such a wrong message to the rest of the world. And Muslims were being hammered on both sides. And I think we've grown up through that. And our generation is much, much more aware.
Well, that's it for this programme. Now it's your turn. What do you remember? What's been the legacy? Join the debate on Comment is Free. I'm Madeline Bunting, and the producer of the programme was Francesca Panetta.